It is 11:46 a.m. Mountain Time here at the University of Northern Colorado. I'm Dave Lefkowitz. The show is Dave's Gone By, and the whole point of the show is to mix music and humor and discourse and interviews, and we're going to do a bit of all of that now with our guest in the neighborhood. He is an author, a political pundit, a media-savvy writer. He has a new book out called The Wizards of Spin, America's Favorite News Stars. And so he would be the perfect person this particular week, considering all that's been going on in the news since Obama's big announcement on Sunday night, to just talk about news, the way news is spinned, the way it's chewed up and masticated in media and popular culture, and everything revolving around that. So if you would welcome to the neighborhood with me, Mr. John Ruane. Hello, John. Hi. How are you doing?
Hi, Dave. Good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm very, very happy to. And so what's this week been like for you?
Well, you know, I think this has been a watershed week for all Americans. And, you know, as I sat there and that news came over, it was like it hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, it was like the weight of the world it came off of all of us. It's like we actually got this guy that we've been chasing forever, and it just was such a good feeling.
Did you think it would ever happen?
I'm sorry?
Did you think it would ever happen?
Boy, you know, I really had my doubts. You know, when with the Bush administration, it just seemed like they didn't really focus on it because they started the other war, and then when Obama got in the administration, he went where we should have been going in the first place, which was Afghanistan. So I think I felt better about our chances of getting him now rather than before. Although, as the news has come out, we've learned that that initial courier tracking started with the Bush administration, I think back in 2007 at that point. But, you know, we all thought this guy was, you know, in a cave and, you know, living off of nothing and just really hiding. But, you know, he's living in this big mansion, you know, drinking Pepsis and downing donuts.
God. And just, what, a couple of miles from Islamabad? Or not even? I mean, that's the historical part.
I mean, there's so much about this that, you know, now, I mean, after we've gotten past the few days of that really turns out to be kind of funny about it, because, you know, they build this huge compound in this area, and the neighbors come by, and they're saying, you know, hey, what's with the 12-foot walls and the barbed wire? And then the guy's excuse, the courier's excuse was, oh, you know, I got a relative who doesn't like me.
So, oh, man.
What do you got? You got a mother-in-law who walks around with a howitzer? Or what's the story here, buddy? You know, it's like, you've got to be kidding. I mean, if you saw a neighbor putting up 12-foot walls and barbed wire fence, you know, that might raise a red flag, wouldn't you think?
Well, no, because neighbors hate me, too. So I would totally understand if a neighbor wanted to put, you know, big barbed wire walls up near me. I would get that immediately. But let me ask,
from a media standpoint, though, what I mean, that's, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about this. You know, I have a background in both as a journalist and in public relations as well. So, you know, as good as this mission was run in order to get bin Laden is almost as bad as the communications was in announcing it to the world.
How can you
not be ready for this, and why would you put out anything that you're not, you know, 100% positive? Plus, they have the guys, the Navy SEALs and the CIA, who know what the story is. So, what do you, you know, the way they first introduced it was, you know, I don't know if you saw NBC or not, but the helicopters land and they had it set up where when once they get out of the helicopter, they're being fired on immediately, you know, and then maybe they made the way around, but that's not what happened at all. You know, they landed the helicopters, they jumped off the helicopters, they busted in the door, and then they started looking, and one guy, not everybody, had a firearm, and that's what the firefight was all about at that point. You know, they made it sound like bin Laden, you know, had a gun and was firing at them and grabbed the woman and put her in front of her, and, oh, no, that's wrong. That's wrong, too. So, as it turns out...
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Well, I just want to know why that happened. Why couldn't Obama have gone on the air on Sunday night and said, you know, bin Laden, we got him. He's dead. Details to follow this week. Why couldn't he have just said that? How did it get to the point of almost everything he gave of details had to be corrected within 24 or 48 hours. Why does that still happen?
You know, and he's really depending on, obviously, his communications people in that case. And as you listen to the reports, it's almost like, what is Leon Panetta doing? Is he the one that was responsible for that? There had to be somebody responsible for getting those communications and passing them along to Obama, who obviously trusted it. And I think at some point when they learned what really happened, I mean, a lesser president would have let it go because they're the only ones who could report it, right?
Right.
But,
yeah.
You know, he corrected it, so give him credit for that.
You know, that's fair. That could have kept the official story what it was.
Right.
And it wouldn't have been until 3 years later and WikiLeaks, if Julian Assange doesn't get put in jail, they would have said, oh, you know, we've just found out through declassified documents that we stole that there wasn't really a firefight. It was one guy with a water pistol or something like that.
But and that's my question is, who is providing that communications? Was it, you know, Garvey or was it Leon Panetta? And then Leon Panetta, you know, like the next day they're asking him about the photo. He says, oh, yeah, I'd let the world see it. I mean, keep your mouth shut, buddy. Make the official statement from the president if they're going to do it or not. I mean, that's just so irresponsible. I mean, if I was in a communications role, I would have been extremely upset if with Leon Panetta giving out that information at that point. But,
well, do you think America has a right to see the photos?
Personally, I think it's a really good idea not to show the photos at this time. I mean, this just happened. You don't need to inflame terrorists any more than they are. I know, obviously, it's one of two things here. It's either they're going to become more intensified in what they're doing, or maybe some of them are going to pull back or pull out completely. And what's going on in the Middle East with all of these, you know, countries being overtaken and rebellion going on, you know, it's really the perfect time to catch Osama bin Laden, quite frankly. But the beauty is they've got all of that information that was on those hard drives and everything. So we've been totally tipped off now on what's going on.
And what about the body? What do you think the real reason is that they stuffed his body in the ocean? I mean, you really buy the line where they say, well, if we put the body anywhere, that'll become a shrine, and the martyrs will come and start trying to blow it up or start to pray there, or it'll become a weird tourist attraction. I just don't buy that at all. Why do you think they got rid of the body?
When I first heard it, I couldn't believe it, because then all of a sudden you're going to have these people who doubt that it happened and conspiracy theorists. That's obviously going to happen now, because unless they can see it, they're just not going to believe it. So, but I would tell you that if they had brought him and buried him in the ground, yeah, I think it would have become a focal point for him as a martyr, and they would have rallied around it. I really do. I think they made the right decision there in dumping him in the ocean at that point. Now let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How many boats and scuba divers are going to be out in that ocean now?
That never occurred to me. Get to them before the sharks do. Oh,
I'm telling
funny.
You, if you think the Titanic was being looked after, they're really going to be looking for this guy. I mean, can you imagine if somebody finds him? Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's the thing. Maybe, who knows if that's just a story, too. I would say if I were the president or if I were the Navy or anybody involved in all this, I'd say, well, tell them what we want to tell them. We're going to keep the body, I don't know, in Fort Knox or in some laboratory somewhere. Well, I can tell anybody where.
Yeah,
but we're keeping
that's actually,
the body.
That would have been a good idea, except from what their story was, is that the Muslims would have been very upset with the U.S. if we didn't do it, in the Muslim tradition, although, you know, now a lot of Muslims are saying we didn't do it right anyway, so you can't please anybody, I guess, along those lines. But, you know, the whole thing is really become very, very funny in many ways. You know, just the whole idea of that Pepsi thing, and, you know, him, he's still in bed when they bust through the door, and they're telling you how loud those helicopters are, you know, and, you know, the stories will be coming out, you know, yeah, we busted through the door, and he was in Winnie the Pooh pajamas, you know, who knows what they're going to be coming up with now, you know? And, you know, just he was watching Donald Trump or something, you know? It's crazy stuff that, you know, all along the line here, it's really free reign, is it not? I mean, the only people who know what happened are those Navy SEALs and the CIA people. So, you know, people can say what they want. They can throw it on the internet. And I think in these coming weeks, you're going to see a lot of crazy things on the internet.
Well, the thing is, I mean, it also occurs to me, like, okay, you've got Pakistan that looks ridiculous. They look like embarrassed fools, rightfully so, because here's this guy hiding in their midst. They had to know. But at the same time, Obama thanks them for the cooperation. And you figure if the American military was able to land a helicopter right in the middle, you know, fly over airspace, somebody in Pakistan had to know they were going through this, or else Pakistan would have shot down the American copter, no?
Well, you know, that's one of the big questions right now is, did they know? I mean, are they that inept? And, you know, the fact is that when back in the late 90s, when Clinton did tip them off, you know, they took off on him. So if they did tell the Pakistanis, I think they would have told them as the mission was happening so they couldn't tip off Osama bin Laden and his courier. So, you know, I mean, you can understand everything that was done. You just, you know, I think we just have to be thankful that he's gone. And, you know, initially it was, you know, it was a firefight and they shot him, and now it's, you know, they basically executed him. And either way, most Americans that I've listened to are happy either way. I mean,
yeah, we all
he's a mass murderer, he's a bad guy, and he's gone from us, you know, at this point. So in terms of the stories, though, you know, the way it stands right now, I wonder if it'll change even further. You know, the Navy SEALs and the CIA aren't supposed to be saying anything. They have showed the pictures to Congress and everything. So, you know, I think that...
So are you saying... Hold on. Are you saying that Congress has seen the pictures of the body?
Yeah, I was reported the other day, that Congress actually has seen the photos, is what I was... is a report that I had heard.
Well, that's a good idea. I mean, at least for all the naysayers and the doubters and things like that, maybe America per se doesn't need all these photos floating around on the internet, because I don't know, they're inflammatory or horrifying. Although, I mean, if all you have to do is go surf three websites and you'll find people with their heads rolling along the gutter. I mean, you know, there's a zillion websites showing faces of death kinds of things. But as long as there's a bunch of people who have seen it and can vouch, whoa, okay. Now, yeah, maybe it's not going to be on the internet. Maybe you're not going to see it and your folks won't see it. But trust me, you know, I've seen it. My colleague in Congress has seen it. They got him. It's him. He's dead. It's high. His face is half blown off.
And then the conspiracy theorists would have to say, well, you're all in on it. Well, you know, that's doubtful because they don't get along in Congress.
Right.
So, you know, if you're showing it to all of them, you know, you've got to accept it. I accept it on face value anyway, because, you know, I believe Obama. You know what was really funny about it? Did you see the picture of them in the room watching the action as it was coming down?
No,
with
no,
the stunned
no.
Look, with the stunned look on their faces, and Hillary Clinton had her hand over her mouth.
Oh, I did see that picture. That's amazing. Yeah.
And what has become funny about that now is, you know, they said that when the actual raid was happening, the video blacked out. So they're claiming they didn't see the actual raid, okay?
Uh-huh.
And Hillary Clinton is now saying that, you know, there was nothing that she was watching that was shocking. It was just, you know, her allergies might have flared up and she might have started coughing, which is, you know, she can join her husband as one of the big liars in the country saying something like that. I mean, the look on her face was like, you know, she'd just seen something awful, and the claim she was, you know, concerned about coughing is a complete joke.
Well, you know, I'll give her, well, I'm not going to give her the benefit of a doubt of telling the truth, but I'm just saying the whole thing must have been so scary and hopeful and exciting to watch, even just the idea of this helicopter landing, who knows what could happen. Maybe she didn't just see the moment when bin Laden got blown away. Maybe she's just seeing these Marines going into the compound, and, you know, you're
right,
going to be like,
and that's literally what she should have, that's what she should have said.
Yeah.
You know, because if you look at Obama's face and you look at the other people in the room, they're all, you know, very intensely looking at that screen. So they're watching something on there. And, you know, and for her to say she's worried about coughing, I think is funny. I think those kinds of stories, I mean, I think that hurts them a little bit. Just stay on the truth track, and, you know, he's dead. It's over with. You know, it was a terrific mission. No, it's a part of our history that we can, you know, put behind us now and move on. So I think it's a great thing.
And what's kind of funny is Donald Rumsfeld was in the room, and he's like, oh, I want to watch Touched by an Angel. I'm like, oh, shut up. You know.
Yeah. And now about Donald Rumsfeld, you know, right? He caught all that heat for the waterboarding and everything, and he goes on one of the Sunday, no, it wasn't Sunday morning, it was on one of the news shows, and he says that Oh, yeah, you know, it turns out that the waterboarding turned up the information that led to the courier. And you know what? That's true. It actually did. Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded, and he's the one that gave out the courier's name.
And I think it was waterboarded 186 times, and that's fine by me. You know,
I mean, that's literally what happened. And, you know, certainly that's the point of contention on this whole thing, and something that America has to really discuss and decide, you know, who are we as Americans? Do we do this type of thing, even if it's, you know, somebody who's involved in mass murder like this against our innocent people? So
we are talking with John Ruane. It is just after noon on this May 7th, 2011, here at the University of Northern Colorado. You're listening to Dave's Gone By with me, Dave Lefkowitz, on uncradio.com. John Ruane is an author and media-savvy political pundit and critic. He is the author of The Wizards of Spin, America's Favorite News Stars. Please tell us, John, about the book.
Okay, well, I wrote this book in 2008 when the country had really hit a low point. You know, people were really down and depressed. I felt like, you know, one of the things that a lot of Americans do when they're out of work is they watch these television news talk show hosts who have become major celebrities in this country. So I felt like if I could write satirical stories about them, A, it would educate them about who these people are, and B, it would provide some entertainment for them and some laughs. And that's literally what's happened. Now the reviews have really supported that. You know, people have really enjoyed this book a lot. And you know, the things you're going to learn about, you're going to learn about who Bill O'Reilly was growing up, who Keith Olbermann was growing up, Chris Matthews, what he's all about, a little bit on Oprah Winfrey, you know, all the way down the line, even Dennis Miller, Steve Colbert, John Daly, Conan O'Brien, David Letterman. I've got stories on all these guys.
But
so,
you're not making that stuff. I mean, you're telling the true stories, but in a humorous way, or are you making stuff up?
Well, I've taken the truth, and I've satirized it, so you have to call it fiction at that point. But yeah, I've introduced some fiction into the truth, but you know, a good deal of this is, it's all based on truth, every one of them. So people should, when they read this, they should understand that yes, it's fiction. You know, this didn't really happen, but what it does is a good satire should point out the truth of a situation.
I would love, I know it's kind of difficult on the radio unless you're physically reading it, but is there kind of an example you could give us of one of these people and how you approach them in the book, The Wizards of Spin?
I think maybe a lot of your listeners would be fans of Stephen Colbert and John Daly as I am, or John Stewart as I am.
John Daly has a good swing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. And
especially when he's hitting his wife. Sorry.
What I thought was really interesting was when NBC bent over backwards to give Conan O'Brien the Tonight Show when Jay Leno was doing fine, and you know, all of a sudden made that big change. And you know, a lot of people don't even think Conan O'Brien's funny. Some people do, obviously, but there's a lot of people who don't even think he's funny. Did he deserve that chair? Well, the question is, you've got these two comic geniuses, Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart, and here they are relegated to cable. So what the story goes is that, you know, these two guys go to some dive restaurant in Hell's Kitchen where, you know, they have, like, their Polaroid pictures tacked on a plywood wall while they're being served by, you know, not so good waiters at that point, while Conan O'Brien is out in Beverly Hills eating at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And you know, he's being wined and dined. But the interesting thing there is, and if you've been to Hollywood, you know this: a guy like that sits in a restaurant like that, and all of a sudden, the entire waitstaff starts doing an audition for him. They're throwing scripts at him. They're doing auditions as they're serving him. All of that's in the book this way. Actually, that's one of the chapters that's gotten tremendous reviews. It's funny, no doubt about it. And you know, I'm a big fan of both Colbert and Jon Stewart. And even Jay Leno's in there as well. And then one on David Letterman, I'm a big David Letterman fan as well, is have you ever sat there and watched him interview an actress who may be a great actress, but all of a sudden she gets on David Letterman and she thinks she's funny too. She thinks she's interesting. She thinks she can tell her own stories. And, you know, sometimes it just falls completely flat. And that's what I did, is I presented that scenario, and in this case, David Letterman, after, you know, 30 years of going through this, finally loses it with her and lets her have it. Yeah, and that again, I mean, that's a that's a pretty funny chapter as it is too. But
and,
you know,
not quite not quite the truth, but also obviously he's had his issues with people like Madonna and Cher, where he did almost kind of, you know, lose it a little bit of like, what the what? Come on, what's the matter? Or he did it with that who was that actor who was in character, the Johnny Cash?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. He was just on there again recently. So I know exactly who you're talking about. The guy came out with the beard and the glasses, and he played Johnny Cash and all that. Yeah, I can't. I'm blanking on his name right now, but yeah, I mean that's exactly right. We're talking. I actually I changed the names in here, but it's very obvious who I'm talking about. Like Madonna, her name is Morana. Cher is Cher, you know, stuff like that. So it's extremely obvious who the people I'm talking about. I just wanted to underline the fact that. That this is fiction, you know.
Sure.
Willie Geist, on the other hand, he put a book out in a similar vein, but he kept the names the same. I don't think we need to confuse people any more than they're already confused in terms of what's out there, so that's why I changed the names.
And if people want to get The Wizards of Spin, America's favorite news stars, they can get it at Amazon. Amazon.com is the best place?
Yeah, Amazon.com, just type in The Wizards of Spin. It's available in both print as well as in all ebook format. Ooh. So I can tell you one of the things that really surprised the heck out of me about this is, you know, I've made my living in public relations, media relations for the last 20 years now, and I put a chapter at the end of the book about public relations, about a press conference, just to provide, you know, fair balance, because, you know, here I am ripping the media, so I thought I would take a shot at my own profession here. And that chapter has actually gotten the biggest reaction of any of them.
Hmm.
And here's the scary part. 85% of that chapter is the absolute truth.
Tell us something from that chapter that is the total truth that we go, oh, you've got to be kidding.
Okay, this actually happened in 1995. I was brought into a press conference situation where the agency in New York was preparing the celebrity and the spokes doc. So they were introducing a new medicine, and this was for OCD, actually. And when I walked in there, they had this whole room rented out. They had them up on a dais. They were filming it. They were giving them all this feedback on questions and answers and what would happen. And I mean, they spent 3-4 hours on it. And I'm watching this thinking, well, Jesus, any of this really going to happen? Because, you know, I've been a journalist for a long time. So at one point, the client, realizing that, you know, all she cared about was going to get wined and dined at some fancy New York restaurant, which actually happened. So they cut it short. They go wine and dine at a New York restaurant. Then the next day, at the actual press conference, they had this whole thing set up, you know, a regular press conference set up with the dais at the front of it and all the chairs set up. And they have a person at the front table checking the media in. And as it turned out, all of the people that stepped to the table to be checked in were not actual media. They said they were media, but they weren't actual media, and they were being given name tags. They were actually employees of the public relations agency. So they went in there with, you know, NBC tags, New York Times tags, all of them. So when the client asked the agency, the head of the agency, said, hey, it looks like we got a pretty good turnout of the media here, yeah? He says, yeah, you can see their names on there. So he wouldn't actually say who it was, but as it turned out, there's actually a fellow named Sidney Wolf, who's an advocate for public citizens, who comes to these kind of press conferences. Well, in this story, he actually shows up, and he realizes what's going on. Now, the only big twist on this thing is the drug they're introducing in the story is a drug that stops constipation, and it stops it immediately. So it has quite an effect. So that's where a good deal of the humor actually comes out of it is the second they put the pill in the mouth, it's like, you know, their cheeks explode, their eyes explode, boom, out the door they go. So you'd have to read it, though. I thought anybody in public relations or journalism would get a kick out of it. My goodness, everybody who's read that chapter just laughs out loud. So I thought that was very rewarding to hear that.
And where's Stuttering John when you need him at these press conferences? That's what I want to know. Let me ask John Ruane, who is the author of The Wizards of Spin, how did you get into the whole journalism field and studying media and then writing about it?
Well, when I was in college, I was going to do one of two things. I was either going to be a professional athlete or a sports writer. And I actually had a shot as becoming a professional athlete for a very short time, but didn't make it. And then I was very lucky and got hired at the Sun-Times as a sports writer. So I spent 10 years writing basically sports feature stories, covering the news media. And that's really where the news media part came into this. And, you know, just really kind of developed my skills. But the problem was, and I could see that even in 1989, that the business was starting to shrink at that point. Our paper was bought and sold three times, including the Rupert Murdoch. And I had gotten a call from an agency, public relations agency, which I joined at that point. So that was my first introduction into PR. So from that point, you know, actually during my time at Sun-Times, I joined, I was one of the extras I did a story on, talked me into going to the Second City workshops, which I never, ever thought I would be doing in my life. I mean, I wrote satire, but I never could see myself on a stage. Well, I did that. I spent 2 years training there, and I had people in my class like Jeff Garland, Andy Dick, Bobby Hunt.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wait, Jeff Garland. Let's tell, in case people don't know, Jeff Garland, of course, from Curb Your Enthusiasm, Andy Dick from various prison cells. Who else?
Bonnie Hunt, who, you know, a lot of movies, had her own talk show for a while there. Joel Murray, I don't know if people would recognize him right away. He's actually Bill Murray's brother. And
he has another one? I know of Brian Doyle Murray, but I didn't know about Joel Murray. Was he funny? Was he good?
Yeah, I mean, if you ever watch Mad Men, he's one of the characters on Mad Men, but he's also on, and I'm blanking on the name of the show right now, about the couple in Chicago that are a couple of goose. Joel's on that show, too. He's been in if you go to IMBD or whatever it's called, and you IMDb. Just type in Joel Murray, you'll see all of his credits there, but he's done pretty well. Robert Smigel,
My God, Robert Smigel, does he pronounce it Smigel with a sh or sma? I always thought it was Smigel. He's brilliant.
Smigel, yeah.
He's triumphing the comic insult dog.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's what he's famous for. But, you know, he got a break, and Al Franken came through town in 1985, and Bernie Sounds at Second City didn't want Saturday Night Live stealing any more performers. So he sent him to Robert Smigel's show, which was called All You Can Eat in the Temple of Doom, and he signed Robert Smigel as a writer that day, and Robert wrote for SNL for a number of years.
Sure.
That's how he became friends with Conan O'Brien, and when Conan started his show, he had Robert as, you know, the head writer and the main producer, and that's where that lips thing comes from. If you've seen the lips thing on Conan,
right.
All those crazy things you see on there, those are all Robert Smigel products.
Well, Smigel's a genius. Absolutely, and some of the cartoons on Saturday Night Live.
The great, cartoons, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Harlem Globetrotters in Space.
I had stayed in touch with him for a number of years, and actually, he's actually in that story with Conan O'Brien. He's sitting with Conan O'Brien at that Beverly Hills Hotel, so I changed his name, obviously, but that's who that is.
but the thing is, you've mentioned all these people. These are folks who taught you, or were they in training with you when you were at Second City?
Oh, yeah.
They
were in the workshops with me, so we were all being trained together at that point. My interest in those workshops was developing as a writer. You know, everybody has a different thing, and most of the people that are in there actually, they're performers and they're improvisers and that type of thing. I ended up going on to perform in four shows. I've written five satirical plays, but I performed in four of them. You know, I don't view myself as the greatest performer. I did all right. I got great reviews, but it's not the thing that I love doing. I love to write it.
The writing. But the thing is, when you perform, you weren't performing then with Second City. You were performing with the Chi-Town Players?
The Chi-Town Players at that point, yeah. Prior to their auditions at Second City, we got that group off the ground, as did most of those people I just told you about. Robert Smigel got his own group off the ground. Bonnie Hunt, same thing. That's what you do when you're in the workshops. As you got groups off the ground, you got real experience, so that Second City could really take a good look at you on the stage.
Now, could you tell from looking at the people that you mentioned, Bill Murray's brother and Bonnie Hunt and all, could you tell in the workshops that they had something special, or were you surprised that other people we've never heard of were funnier or cleverer or better actors or something, and it just so happens these guys got lucky?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there is no way I would have told you that Andy Dick ever would have made it. Hmm. I mean, he was this nerdy little guy. He wasn't that funny on stage. I mean, he just wasn't that good. But then a few years later, I actually saw him performing with a fellow named Bob Odenkirk in a show called Half My Face is a Clown. And I said, well, I get it. I see it. That's the first time I thought Andy Dick was pretty good. And then the next thing I know, he starts popping up on shows left and right. Jeff Garland, I always thought Jeff Garland was funny. We actually tried to get him into the Chi-Town Players. Same with Bonnie Hunt. Tried to get her into the Chi-Town Players at that point. So I knew both of them had talent. Joe Murray, no way. The only reason Joe is where he's at is because of the name recognition that opened the door for him. But having said that, he's done very well. There were other guys there. There was a guy named Kevin Crowley and a fellow named Dave Pasquazi. Both of
them. Oh, my God. Wait. Dave Pasquazi, he's with TJ and Dave. He was on my show a couple of years ago.
He is a very, very talented guy. And, he's gotten bit parts in movies and things like that, but that is him and Kevin Crowley were the two guys I thought that would really go somewhere. But as it turned out, a lot of the... And actually, Chris Farley was on the stage with them at that point, and Chris was, pretty much what you saw on Saturday Night Live at that point. I got to know Chris pretty well. He was a very nice guy. He just had, a lot of issues with... eating and drinking and drugs, unfortunately, but he was a really nice guy.
That's kind of nice to hear, but he wouldn't listen to... Well, he was an addict, I guess, and so I assume all his friends, if he was a nice guy, probably had a lot of friends who were trying to tell him, you don't want to be the next Belushi, and of course he
was. Well, that's exactly right. He actually, his whole life, though, just so you know, is when he was up in Madison, Wisconsin, his goal was to become John Belushi and die at 33, and he did it.
Yeah,
it's unfortunate. I know a guy up in Wisconsin who used to see him up there doing it, and then when he came down to Chicago, he was with the Players Workshop, and then came over to Second City after that. But it's unfortunate, because I'm telling you, and Robert Smigel was very close with him too, so he was, they all tried, but the track he was on in life. He was going to do that.
So I know you mentioned that you were really there to learn about the writing end of satire and stuff, and now, of course, your main day job when you're not writing your books and other things about the media is that you are a public relations person, but do you sort of miss those heady days of training at Second City and then being part of the Chi-Town Players, or is that like the past and you really want to, you're away from it?
That's a really good question, and this is my answer to that, because I just went to see my friend Dave Pasquazi at the Goodman Theater, where he's in a play there, and I look at Dave's Facebook and I see him around with all the actors and stuff, and I got to tell you, for me, it was what it was, and I'm glad that it was just that short period of time, because I'm really, the best thing I do is I write for book form. I do that better than anything. So for me, I'm in the right spot. For a guy like Dave, I hope he becomes a big star at some point, but he'll continue acting all his life. He's very good. But yeah, I would say no, that's not really something that I would be good in at this point anymore.
Okay. You mentioned again books. I assume Wizards of Spin is not your first book. Can you tell us about
first? Yeah. Coming out as a sports writer, I have a very strong sports interest. My first book was with Earl Campbell, who was MVP of the NFL for 3 years and went on to become a Hall of Fame running back. And the story on him was that, I wrote his entire life story, coming up with 9 kids. They lost their father young, to growing up in Tyler, Texas. He became a hero in the state of Texas because he led his team to the state championship during very strong racial tensions, in line with the movie Remember the Titans. It was like that, even more realistic than that, though. And then he went on to the University of Texas, became the Heisman Trophy winner, went on to the NFL, won the MVP 3 years. So I wrote his life story, but focused on his battle with panic disorder. And the idea is that, men are reluctant to go get help when they have panic attacks and anxiety attacks, and a good number of them end up killing themselves, a lot of suicides. So if they hear a guy like Earl Campbell, this big, strong, powerful running back, actually went and got help, the idea was to inspire them to go get help as well.
You should have just turned them on to Rosie Greer, it's all right to cry. Just giving them that record and it would have been fine.
And he did, and that's absolutely right. And actually, Earl sat in his truck at one point with a gun and was ready to end his own life. And thank God his brother talked him out of it on the phone. So, he's a good friend of mine now. He's in, he's been in Austin, Texas forever. He has his own sausage company, but he told me last time I talked to him, he's actually able to walk now. So his back, he had like 5 back operations.
Yeah.
So I don't know any real Campbell fans there are out there at this point, but great guy, great sports hero in our country.
And he got kind of a happy ending, a second act, where he almost ended after the first.
And then the other book, my second book was actually about, it's called Perish the Thought. It was about growing up Catholic in the 1960s, and the idea behind that is life has changed so much because I'm a parent of four now.
Oh.
I mean, it's so much more pressure on kids today in school, and that everything is scheduled and this and that. And you know, when I grew up, life was, you had more freedom. You know, you could go out and have fun, and you didn't have all the pressure of, 3 hours of homework on you every day and this and that. So that book did very, very well all over the country. And, it's my best book to date, no doubt about it.
Is it what book?
I've got three books on. Yeah. I'm sorry,
what did you say? It's your what book to date? You said
it's my best book to date.
Your best book. Oh, so it's better than the one you just wrote? Well, then everybody, don't get the Wizards. No, I'm kidding.
Well, it's got more impact. It's more meaningful. Mm. The Wizards of Spin is it's there for satire, for a good laugh, and to learn a little bit about the media. But Perish the Thought is about life. So, people will walk away looking back on their own life, quite frankly. So many people sent me letters saying that I had written their life story. That's how much they can relate to the story of this book. And that's just not Catholics. That's Jewish people and, all across the board. It really is. I mean, it talks about my faith growing up because I was Catholic, but it applies to all different faiths.
Can people get the all three books still on Amazon, or the other two, they have to go to eBay or something?
Oh, no, they're all on Amazon.com, and actually I'm currently starting another book, which I can't tell you about, but it's about a sports hero here in Chicago.
Okay. Walter Payton.
I'm getting that off the ground right now. So I met Walter Payton once. I worked with him once. He worked with Michael Jordan, worked with Muhammad Ali, worked with a lot of different sports heroes in my time doing it.
Well, how did you work? What did you do with Muhammad Ali?
Well, I was working on a Parkinson's drug at that point called Mirapex, and Muhammad Ali was taking it to help himself, and we brought him into a major press conference, and he got worldwide attention for talking about Parkinson's and his battle and what he has to do. And, ended up spending, we did a thing in Washington, D.C. with him, and then we did a thing in Chicago with him. And I got to tell you, one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my life, and he was a childhood hero.
Wow.
And, he does not walk away from autographs. He will sign autographs all day long. Just a terrific individual.
He is able to. I mean, it's physically, he can still sign can he talk? I mean, he talks.
I'm over 13 years since I worked with him now.
Oh.
I think he's struggling now more with his signature. What really amazed me when we brought him into NBC in Washington, Brian Gumbel did the interview with him, and up until that point, Muhammad hadn't really said too much. He let his wife Lonnie do most of the talking, but all of a sudden, he could talk, and he could talk well, so when he chose to speak, he sure could.
Wow. I hope he still can. I know it was 13 years ago. Who else have you worked with as a public relations person? And do you have any cool, funny anecdotes about some of the... You can name names I wish you would.
There are certain guys that stick out. Like, Michael Jordan, obviously. We brought him into the Oprah Winfrey Show, and we were sitting back in the green room while his wife was getting her hair and makeup done, and Michael was sitting there. And this is just after he quit basketball for the first time. So he's sitting there reading the Sun-Times, reading the letters to the editor, and how people doubted that he was going to actually go try to play baseball, and he just laughed at it and said they don't know what they're talking about. And we had a press conference, I think, the next day for that, and this is just my, I don't know if this is strike you funny or not, but we were waiting for him for an hour. It was supposed to start at, 5:30, so he walked in the back door at 5:30, went right up to the dais and sat there, and my job was to, lead the media and all that. So I walked up to him, and his head was to the side of me, and I just wanted to know any one-on-one interviews. So I said, any one-on-ones? And then all of a sudden, he turned his face to me, and he was like, his face was like a half an inch away from me. I go, hey, Michael Jordan. All of a sudden, I was face-to-face with Michael Jordan. It was like, I didn't see that coming. Anyway,
You don't get that, even though you've met, worked with, trained with, performed with famous people or people who end up becoming famous and as a PR person, you still get, depending on the celebrity, I'll bet, the occasional goosebump thing, like, oh my God, I'm here with so-and-so, even though you've met probably dozens at this point.
Oh, absolutely. And I will tell you, in Washington, D.C., after that one press conference we had with Muhammad Ali, I went back up to the room and his wife and him, and he was sitting on one chair, and I was, facing to the side of me, and I was sitting on a chair next to him, and he was sitting there eating grapes, you know. And then all of a sudden, he kind of like, which happens to Parkinson's patients, he kind of fell asleep and he started drooling. And I go, hey, I'm sitting here with Muhammad Ali. it was like one of those surreal, you know, moments in life. And there's, you know, one of the most famous people in the world eating grapes and drooling from Parkinson's.
Now, I'm going to give you an opportunity here. And I give you the opportunity. You can say yes or no or whatever. But is there someone that you've worked with as a PR person or in another capacity that was really, really a jerk, and the whole world should know about it?
Well, I will tell you this. I have been lucky. I know people in PR who have worked with jerks. You know, some of the folks I've worked with are Lonnie Anderson, Robert Klein, Roger Clemens, Regis Philbin, Florence Griffith Joyner, all the way down the line. And I have had very good relationships with all of them. And, you know, I just haven't run. But I would tell you, one thing that's a little disappointing about Roger Clemens is, I mean, I got to know him as well as anybody. There's no way I believe that he took steroids.
Oh.
Now I do.
Oh.
Now I do. Yeah. So I'm telling you, he told us till he was blue in the face he would never put anything bad into his body. And, he invited me to his, I was one of only two people that was invited to his mother's funeral in Wake, in Dayton, Ohio. And, I just couldn't believe that this guy could lie like I think he is. I mean, I got to believe that he did take him at this point. I'll tell you, the first time I met him, his mom lived in Katy, Texas. When he walked through the door, he looked like a superhero. I mean, he was a big, strong guy. Now, understand, he busted his butt in the weight room. He had the hardest workout regime I've ever seen for anybody. But, you know, the way the evidence has come down, it's just very hard to believe that he didn't take steroids or some kind of something to help enhance him, his muscles. So
he was working out in this weight room in Pakistan somewhere. It was 2 miles from Islamabad.
I guess so. It was with Osama bin Laden wearing his Winnie the Pooh pajamas, drinking his Pepsi. Hey, do you think Coca-Cola made a deal with one of the Navy SEALs? Hey, when you go in there, tell him he drinks Pepsi. That'll really kill Pepsi's stock and drive ours up. Next thing we know...
No, please, continue.
No, I mean, next thing you know, if you start seeing Navy SEALs on Coke commercials, you know something's up, right?
I wouldn't put anything past anyone now, and I guess you wouldn't either. Last question, because it's almost 12:30 here. Mountain Time on Dave's Gone By on uncradio.com. We're talking to John Ruane, author of the book The Wizards of Spin, America's Favorite News Stars, available from Amazon.com. Second City Books is the publisher there. But do you have any suggestions or advice of how we can, or the media can, stop or lessen the insane polarization between Republicans and Democrats, between Fox News and Huffington Post? I mean, is there anything that can be done to stop the BS and also the insane bipartisanship?
Well, I'll tell you, when that Gifford shooting happened, I put out a press release calling for that because, you know, if you look back at the history of television, you know, they used to have rules about what you could and couldn't say on the air. Well, now, as it's really changed and changed drastically over the last 20 years, it's become a forum for craziness where, you know, guys like Sean Hannity and then Ed Schultz on the other side can just incite their viewers to really hate the other side. And, you know, it does affect our country. So my opinion about it is, yeah, I think there should be some type of a panel of experts put together to lay down guidelines that doesn't infringe on freedom of speech to try to curb this a little bit, because I think it's really gotten out of hand.
And, well, again, I think the media probably can say, well, we are curbing it because we differentiate between what is news, per se, and what is already entertainment.
But that's the problem is many of the people watching it can't really don't really understand what is the news and what is their opinion, they will tell you that it's all their opinion. It's a commentary show. But unfortunately, a lot of the information they're given out that seems like it's a fact is actually their opinion, and people are receiving it as fact. That's why if you go to a barbecue and you sit around and you listen to people talking, it usually comes around to politics at some point, you'll know who they listen to. You'll know if they listen to a Sean Hannity or a Bill O'Reilly or Ned Schultz or whoever.
Or Rachel Maddow or formerly Keith Olbermann, who's
going right.
to have a show again.
Quick note. I actually started this book with Keith Olbermann and Bill O'Reilly because they were at each other's throats so badly that I kept hearing people say, well, why don't they get into the boxing ring? So I wrote that story. They get into a boxing ring in a new Yankee Stadium, and they have a three-round bout, and it is, to me, it's absolutely one of the funnier stories in the book. I've got all of them in there. I've got all the celebrity news people ringside, and I hope people enjoy the heck out of that chapter as well.
That book being The Wizards of Spin, from Second City Books, by our guest in the neighborhood, John Ruane. John, it has been really, really so much fun and informative and playful, just as I expected of a guy who trained at Second City. You really could wing it, whether we were talking seriously or a little more satirically about the news and everything going on. I'm so glad that you've been in the neighborhood with us today. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.